Hello, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I'm one half of Wannabe Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games. And I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
Hello, Jess. I'm Craig Campbell, the owner of Nerdburger Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games, too. And we are here with many-time returning guest, Liana. Hello.
Hi there. My name's Liana. I also make games and like podcast and do like 20 billion other things.
Don't we all do 20 billion other things? Liana, thanks so much for coming back on the show. It's always good to see you.
Yeah, I'm excited. This is a topic I have quite a bit to say on. So.
Yes, I am so excited to get into today's topic. You know, I'm going to throw it over to Craig because I think Craig does a better job of introducing the topics than I do. Craig, what are we talking about today?
Designing a tabletop role-playing game.
Oh, well, we always talk about that.
I think we're going to get, we didn't like, you know, specify like, you know, a specific part of the design process. So I think we'll probably kind of give an overview. We'll talk a whole bunch about designing a game, developing a mechanical system, like what you think you need to have in the game, kind of just coming to terms with like, you know, there are lots of different games, lots of different styles, different play styles, different scales and scopes. And we can kind of get all over that. I imagine it'll turn to mechanics quite a bit because designing your own mechanics can be challenging. And all of this includes like hacking other games too, because amongst the group here, I know we've got at least, you know, we've got people that have hacked other systems. We've got people that have hacked their own systems into new games. So, yeah, let's rock and roll.
Liana, why did you choose this topic for today?
Because like, Jesus, in 2008, I embarked on a life-changing journey, and I think it's good to help people understand the goals and the pitfalls and all of the other potential things that you should know about stepping into building a TTRPG.
Yeah, there's so much that goes into this that like, the topic of doing this is a bit overwhelming. So where do we start when we're deciding that we're going to design a TTRPG system?
I certainly have a recommendation.
Yeah.
I would figure out why. What are you trying to do with this? Especially too, like, there are so many TTRPGs out there. Often there's a decision of like, should I just hack something that already exists or should I create something new? And for me, the biggest questions like we asked when we were designing Valor, which is an anime style tabletop RPG, is like, okay, what do we have? What exists? And what are we trying to accomplish that we think can only be done by what we're trying to design?
So How do you know that? Like, I feel like there are so many games out there that do so many different things. How do you know that it's right for you to decide whether you are going to hack something versus whether you are going to start from scratch, essentially? Although from scratch is maybe not exactly what we're doing when we're designing something.
Well, yeah. But in some cases you are. And That's where research comes in. Like, a lot of my design work is research, as I'm looking into things on the market. I'm looking at what other games do. I'm looking at what other stories do and systems do. So for me, having a clear idea and objective of what it is I'm trying to accomplish was really the first step. Like, we wanted to make a series that was really good at, make a TTRPG that was really good at shonen anime. Like, kind of that battle and the like yelling about feelings and stuff like that. At the time, the system du jour was Besom, which we had tried, and it wasn't really suiting our purposes. So we, you know, looked at, there were a bunch of, you know, smaller indies that kind of did it, but nothing that quite felt right for us. And that is ultimately why we decided to build our own unique bespoke system to do what it was we were trying to do.
I have heard a lot of people like they have started designing their own. I've heard it both ways. Like someone will start by designing their own system, they start iterating, and then they end up playing a game that they're like, oh my gosh, like this worked so well. This would work so well for the game that I'm currently designing. I'm gonna completely overhaul and just kind of decide to either like partial hack or like hack this part of the system and put it to mine. But I've also heard it the other way around. I mean, just a couple like last month we were talking to Lila Fujiwara, and she was talking about how they were designing the jukebox RPG, starting off with like hacking something and then deciding, oh, it should probably actually be its own system. Like I've heard it both ways, and I think like you're so spot on when you say that part of game design is research. And research for a game designer means knowing a lot about other games and what they're doing. Because you might be surprised, like, is it kind of a badge of honor? Like, I'm saying some people think that it's a badge of honor to create their own system, put blood, sweat, and tears into it. That's not necessarily the case. It's not like more valuable to like completely design something top down than it is to hack a system. They both have their functions and their purposes. And like I said, even if we are designing from scratch, we're not really designing from nothing. None of us design in a void. We're all in this big conversation of design, like reacting to what other people are doing and iterating on it and putting your own plays and thoughts on how things are working. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I know for me, I guess I should backtrack a bit. If you want to design your own system and you just want to do it, like that
Yeah.
is a worthy pursuit in and of itself. But if you are trying to design and you want to like try and bring it to market, maybe in like the indie space or whatever, that's really where that research is gonna come in. So like, don't let me dissuade you from just building your own system if you want to do that. Like, people do that all of the time. It's a great exercise. It's a lot of fun. But if you are looking to do something more substantive, more polished, I guess, yeah, the very, very first step is have a clear vision of what you're trying to do and knowing what the other systems in your space are doing.
And you might give some thought to also like what is your goal for your involvement in the industry in general? Is like Liana made the comment, you can just make a game and that's fun. And you can just make a game if that's all you're really looking to do. You just want to make a thing that you can put into the hands of your friends, maybe put up on Itch or DriveThruRPG. But like if you're looking to like I want to move myself into a career, like I want this to be something that is going to support me, then you might make different decisions about how you're going to approach things. You might decide that the better route is to use an existing system to, to build something off of D20, off of Fate, or do a Powered by the Apocalypse game or something like that. Because there's a user base, there's a player base out there that's already familiar with that system that you might pull in. You have to think about those sorts of things. But for those of us who are like, I just want to make a thing that's all me, that's my baby that I created from the ground up, then it definitely we go deeper into what Liana was talking about, like knowing what it is you want to do with the game and figuring out how you can present that in text at, for the purposes of describing and lore and setting and what the game is about and how you play it, but then also like how the mechanics might reflect that those goals that you have, those things that you're trying to do with the game. And then one of the things I like to throw in there too, not beyond just what the game is about, what the characters do, what the world looks like, is also what play experience do you want the players to have? Because different games have different experiences. Some games are power fantasies. Some games are wily, kind of shoot 'em up, raucous time kind of things. But things, some are grim and dark, and like, oh my God, my character might die at any moment, and that's the experience you're giving this anxiety, this like you have to be super careful, or it might be political, and there's lots of secrets, and that's what you want everybody to keep secrets. So yeah, just like dig down into all that sort of stuff. And then you could that can help to inform what you're doing for how you're writing the instructional stuff, for how you're presenting the setting and the lore, and for how you're doing mechanics.
Yeah, the mechanics, like figuring out your main mechanic, like the main, like what do you want the system to do? Because I mean, okay, you decide to make your own thing, or whether you're hacking it or making your own, it doesn't matter. Like, what is the main thing that the players are going to be doing within your game? Figuring out how you're going to handle that within the mechanics of the game and within the role play of your role playing game, because hopefully you're adding some role play to your role playing game. that's like the number, like you get that settled down and locked in, and then you can design everything else around that to make sure it's all cohesive. But if your game doesn't accomplish that core value, if you don't have a core value for your game, or you don't have a core conceit for your game, and you don't have a core mechanic that achieves that conceit, then everything else will feel like just a slapdash collection of mechanics and things that you're just kind of doing. It's so, like, Liana, like, starting from what you want to do and what you would want to accomplish, like, and keeping that through line through this entire creative design process, that's your safety line for success. That's your guideline, your path. If you see yourself deviating from that too much, you're designing a different game at that point, which is cool too. You might be doing that. But I also look, another thing you said, that if you're designing just for yourself, just to do it, you don't necessarily need to follow that either. You can have a slapdash collection of random stuff. That's also valuable. That's fun to do sometimes. People like designing little mechanics, like, oh, here's a cool mechanic. I don't know what it does or what it's for. It's in my notebook now. Maybe I'll use it later. Maybe I won't. But it's there. I had that fun little thought experiment. I worked my brain. I challenged myself. That is also game design, even if it's not publishing with the goal of publishing in the future.
I mean, sometimes, like, I got to participate. There's a local organization called Alexandria Library. They're an Alexandria RPG library. They do a lot of RPGs and stuff. So I got to participate in their Iron Designer event one year, where, you know, it's kind of the Iron Chef thing where they keep throwing out, like, secret ingredients.
Sounds of, like, so fun.
Different things. So I ended up making a TTRPG, as is my style. And I had this kind of, like, heisty or, like, secret agent sort of combat-y thing with, like, magic based around, like, concrete and rebar and, like, this necromantic juice that people were getting addicted to. And sometimes you just kind of go, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, like, that's, like, exercising your mind as a game designer. If you throw it all away, like, even if you never touch it again, you did the thing and you made yourself a better game designer by doing that. Although that's a little beyond the scope of our topic for today, that's still a fun thing to do, which is why I think a lot of game designers like to design their own stuff from scratch rather than hacking, because we enjoy that sort of problem solving or creativity and innovation. Yeah. I want to hear from both of you. So you have that idea, like you said, you have, like, you had a heisty sort of thing for your Alexandria Iron Gate. What was it, Iron Designer?
Iron Designer. Yeah.
Iron Designer. Yeah. We've all designed different games. Once you have that idea, how do you experiment with the right mechanics to make it happen? What do we do?
A lot of that really, like, I'm going to actually take this back to Valor, since we worked a lot on that. I actually, for Iron Designer, I was taking part in the TTRPG mentorship program at the time, so I decided pretty early on I was going to test out one of the mechanics that my mentee had developed. So as it started to come together, I'm like, yeah, I think I can fit this in. And it was a kind of a limited dice pool idea, where you have a maximum number of dice you can put in, but each, like, point above that maximum lets you roll additional dice, and then you pick which ones, which was kind of a fun thing. But, like, for Valor, what I did Well, we ended up, we sat down, we pulled a list, all right? It's like shonen anime. Okay, so like, what do we need to be able to do? Here's Bleach. Here's all the stuff they do in Bleach. Here's Naruto. Here's all the stuff they do in Naruto. Here's JoJo's. Here's everything they do in JoJo's. We're not going to do the world because that's busted as hell. And then every mechanic we always designed with that core guiding principle. So it's like, all right, this is shown in anime. Instead of rolling against AC, we're going to do opposed rolls. And you're going to actually d choose how you defend yourself because that's very anime, right? We're going to have the valor system where you slowly accrue investment in a scene over time, and then you can like spend that to do really cool things because that, again, that's already shown in anime where they're always like drawing on their inner reserves to do something. And then, you know, it's like, all right, we're going to make a technique system that's highly modular and customizable because shonen characters don't really fall into like class archetypes, so that doesn't fit for our game. Everything we did, every decision we made, every design choice we put into this was focused on what it was we were trying to accomplish. And you kind of alluded to this earlier, like if you're really going to go in on this, that vision is your guidepost. Anytime you're stuck, go back to the concept, go back to the vision. Everything you're doing should be in service of providing that singular experience that you have decided you're going to do.
Craig, do you have a similar story of designing a game?
As far as like how do I get that first, you know, that first thrust of figuring out what the mechanics are going to look like?
Yeah.
For me, it usually ends up being kind of a very internal, iterative kind of thing to start with. It's often just like in a note, you know, notes app or in a Word document where I'm just, but here's a bunch of different ideas of how I could do this game mechanic. And then I look at like, you know, how do you determine successes and if there's like if it's just pass fail or if there's degrees of success and failure and kind of work out different ideas. And then usually it comes to like I'm just brainstorming stuff, right? So like that's happening off and on for a while. And I might even set it all aside for a while and you come back with fresh eyes and you look at it and you go like, okay, that one doesn't sing really to me anymore. And it's like, oh, and now I see an inherent problem. Like this won't do what I'm looking for it to do. And you kind of narrow things down. And eventually you get to a point where you've got something that you can potentially like just sit down with like, okay, I know the basics of the system that I've got. I'm going to create a fake starting level character by just setting some arbitrary rules for creating a character, what I think that might look like, and be like, okay, now I'm going to roll some dice. Just, you know, roll some dice. See how the like see what your spread of numbers looks like, how it kind of, you know, whether what you're hitting, whether you're getting like the variation of successes and failures and the degrees of things that you're looking for. And making sure that, you know, like safeguarding against like making sure that you're not accidentally designing something like, oh, I've got target numbers that range up to 15, but I can't possibly hit a 15 with the rules like it. I got to make sure I'm, you know, my target is where it needs to be. Or I've got to expand how the game works so that you can get more bonuses or you roll bigger dice or whatever. So they've got these more swingy kind of a thing that's going on. And then it comes to a point of like the most rudimentary thing gets put down on the table or, you know, often nowadays it's virtually on Zoom. With a few people to just run a rudimentary game or even just run some combats or some scenarios where you're going to be rolling dice for the system and seeing if it has legs. Like, does this doing what I'm looking for to do in that, you know, referring to all the things we've been talking about, all the core conceit and the player experience and everything you're trying to do. And then, you know, that's usually like, oh yeah, that works. Or no, it does not. And then it's a question of do I tweak that or do I try something else? And I've done both. I've had times where I've tweaked it and I've had times where I've been like, nope, this system is not doing what I wanted it to do. And that game went on the shelf for like 2 years. And then it came back with it with a different system when I was like, oh, wait a minute, this system would work for that thing. And that's how Code Warriors came to be. Because it had a completely different system when I play tested it at Gen Con 1 year. And it was a fine playtest. We all had a good time, but I just didn't feel like it was working. Yeah, that's, you know, it's and then once you kind of and that gives you then that gives you confidence. Like once you start to see like, oh, I crunch some numbers or I use some of those online emulators that kind of do percentage that'll give you the statistics for different dice rolls and so forth. Or in my case, I even have a guy, I have a person who is a statistics person. They teach, you know, they're like, you know, working at a college professor, and they teach and they love, like, just it, they find it fun to create Excel spreadsheets with formulas. Like, that's just a fun thing for them. So I'm like, okay, here's some money. Make us an Excel spreadsheet that determines the, you know, degrees of success and percentages of success and failure and everything. And we do that. I've done that like 4 times with them. And then once you kind of got the confidence and it's kind of rolling, then it becomes like expanding it, fine-tuning it. And as Leanna said, always kind of keeping your eye on the prize, like keeping in mind the things that you're trying to do, whatever it is you have set as your goal.
I mean, even within the same kind of genre of something, you can have a completely different feel and therefore also mechanics that you're adding into your game. Because I mean, if you're looking at shonen anime, for example, like there's a lot of stuff that can go into show. Maybe you want to focus on the tournament arcs of a shonen anime. That's going to be a different style. It's going to be a different kind of through line than you would have if it's going to be more like a, oh, now all I can think about is tournament arcs.
Well, and that's actually, that is an interesting thing. Since tournament arcs, our system isn't necessarily well suited at just a tournament, but we do tournament arcs pretty fun. Because if you're just designing for a tournament, that actually flattens a lot of the design because one-on-one fights
Right.
are not are kind of a sometimes thing for us, but not an every time thing. So if everyone's just designing to go one-on-one, it doesn't quite work. But if you throw everyone into the ring with the builds that they've been building for general purpose adventuring, it makes things very interesting.
Yeah,
And
and I
that was,
mean,
you know, sacrifices and gains, right?
if you want something that's more broad, it's covering a broader kind of idea. You're kind of not necessarily sacrificing, but you're making the you're making the concession that the littler, smaller details aren't necessarily going to be perfected in that way. You can't have a game that does everything within that big umbrella so perfectly. Otherwise, that's just real life. Maybe in the future, some very genius game designer will be able to do this, but you could also then take the other end, like, I just want this little glimpse into this part of this genre or this trope or this idea. And then you could do that one thing perfectly. It's going to be a much smaller scope game that only tells like a specific kind of story, but that's also a different kind of like, that's something you have to decide too. Is this going to be something that is more versatile that you can play for a longer period of time with more versatility with different, campaign style, or is it going to be like a one shot? We are just doing this little look into vignette kind of deal. Those are like, I love both kinds of games. They both have their they both have their values. They're of course like even just within a very specific genre like Eldritch horror, like Cthulhu inspired, you know, like Lovecraft inspired horror is huge in role playing games. Even within that, there are different feels that you can get within a game that can be affected by the mechanics you're using. Like Call of Cthulhu has a very different kind of idea that you're following compared to like Delta Green, which is more you know, investigative versus like the Arkham Horror series, which is more pulp. Even though they're all within kind of the same realm, the mechanics allow the characters to do different things, and kind of have a different game experience. And whereas like Arkham Horror doesn't do the doesn't do investigative as well as a gumshoe system might do, but it, you know, Call of Cthulhu doesn't let you like have characters that are maybe gonna live at the end. Like, you know, they'll get a little push and pull there.
Because that just reminds me of the one time we played Arkham Horror, we drew Yig, I think it was, like the weakest of the completely failed to like stop the summoning and then just blew him out of the water. Like he showed up and then suddenly magic gunfire from every corner. And I think
Yeah.
we kind of we didn't do that quite right,
Oh,
but you
I
know,
love
it
that's
was
why
a
I
good
love
time.
that board game. That board game is so fun. There's an RPG for it now, which kind of like gets that pulp feel too, like all the weird, it's kind of like ridiculous at times, I feel like the way the game system lets you handle things. But you can't get that. Like Call of Cthulhu is a little tiny bit more serious and grounded than that pulp style. I mean, even within like a specific like game line, like if we're thinking about like the Savage Worlds game line, like every one of those has a different feel just because they're adding different mechanics into it to let you play like a different style. And yeah, that's I really like that about games, is that you can just like change one little mechanic and allow a different player experience.
I've had a lot of fun with that with the roll track system, where when you get multiple successes and you mark things on tracks, and like every game, you mark stuff on three different tracks, but those three tracks are different in every game, and so they mean different things to the game. So sometimes it's kind of bad when you fill up this track because it means like darkness is following you, and in another game, that same track is like building up superpowers.
Yeah, like the dressing you put over your game mechanic can change it so much. Like, ninth level games polymorph system, very, very simple system. It's used in all of their polymorph games, but they have anything going from like Kobolds Ate My Baby to mazes. Like, those are two very different games. Or Pigeons 11. Heisting pigeons is not the same as going through a dark dungeon. And having your character slowly die. But each of them also like kind of changes that system a little bit and adds its own little like here's what this specific role does. I think that's part of like the research step is seeing what other designers are doing even within their own one system. And when you're designing your system, like, okay, does it do what these games are doing? Does it fit that kind of system? Or if you're hacking a system, reading a bunch of or playing a bunch of games within that system and then deciding like, oh yeah, I like how they did this and they did this and I'm gonna make my game this way instead. A lot of that you're gonna have to continue to research as you keep playing, as you keep designing. What about do we have experience hacking other systems? I've hacked systems for
I have
sure.
as well, yeah.
I've hacked my own systems. I've iterated the system into different things, but I haven't specifically. I've come close a few times where I'm like, ooh, I should like I've got this game idea, and like that would work really good with the Morkborg system, or this would be like a good like this could be a really neat Powered by the Apocalypse game. But mostly I tend to end up falling away from it because it means that I need to get super familiar with the other system. And that's there's nothing wrong with that, like reading the system and playing some games. But I know that when I'm doing that, I'm gonna also be bouncing ideas in my head about like how I could do it, and like I find that more satisfying. So that's where I usually end up. Although that said, like I said, I have hacked my own game systems into different things, like Good Strong Hands and Cosmic Corsairs use the same core mechanic, but they're vastly different play experiences. In terms of what those mechanics ultimately mean for the game. And one of them makes the system player facing, and one of them makes the system player and GM facing. So it's a more complex system where, you've got more, you're dealing with like, health levels and targeting to hit and all that sort of thing. Whereas the other one is much more free flowing. And it's like, oh, I'm gonna make a trait check to do this thing. And the GM never rolls anything. They just set target numbers that make things interesting for you.
What would you say the percentage of difference is between like your two hacked systems? Like how much of the DNA is similar and how much of it is different?
I would say from Good Strong Hands to Nowhereville to Code Warriors, the DNA is like 85% the same. And I would say that when you get to Cosmic Corsairs, it's only maybe about 50%. Like it's significantly different. You still have four traits, you have skills that give you an extra, and you're rolling dice pools, you have skills that give you an extra die, and you've got a series of target numbers, but the die type that you're using changes to something a little more swingy for one of the games, for Cosmic Corsairs. And then it like I said, it becomes a whole player and GM facing thing, which makes it much more complex. There's just much more going on because it's not just players with a handful of traits and target numbers to deal with.
If you'd like, I can tell a tale of woe and hacking D&D
Yeah. Let's hear it.
3.5 into
Yes.
Bleach.
Yes. Yes.
Yes, please.
So the reason Valor exists is in no small part because I first attempted to do a very specific Bleach hack for D&D 3.5, D20. And I was honestly in some respects quite successful in that the original rule set that I created ended up going on. I think they were still supporting it up until like 2014 or something like that. And this was made in like 2006, 7, right before I just said, screw it, I'm going to make my own system because this isn't quite working. But with hacking, it's kind of, I know for me, my experience was very much, I got it to work, but it was kind of miserable. And that comes back to choosing the right system. I have seen a lot of people who absolutely love Powered by the Apocalypse, for example, and I have seen a lot of people who are like, I feel like I have to because Powered by the Apocalypse is the indie darling. So, kind of like D&D for mainstream stuff, if you're not using this, then no one's going to play your game, right? But at the end of the day, if it doesn't suit, it doesn't suit. Like for Bleach D20, I stripped it down to like generic classes, like kind of a fighter, rogue, and mage type for like the Shinigami. I created this whole modular system to create the Zanpakuto, the swords, where you can like pick elements and you can like start stacking attributes. It was definitely a precursor to how Valor worked. But it was barely resembled D20 by the end of it. And usually I would say if you're getting to that point where your hacked system doesn't really resemble the thing that you're working with, that might be a good sign that you really should just be making your own.
I think that that is like such a quintessential game designer experience. Like, here's this game that I play and that I like, and I want to do this though with it. And my friends want to play Bleach, but we all play D&D. I can make it happen. I can make it happen. I have done this too. Like, this game system is really, I'm really kicking its tires. It's really bulging at the seams. It is starting to escape. And like that, you're exactly right. Like, what as soon as like the main mechanics of that system you're trying to hack no longer serve that purpose that you're trying to get to, and you're designing more than you are adapting, yeah, just make your own system at that point. You probably have the chops to do it if you've already been. I think it's harder at times to try to hack a system and make it fit with what you're trying to do, in many ways. But this is also something that game designers are still doing or maybe forced to do, especially with a lot of IP games. Like they'll buy an IP and make a game based off of it, and maybe originally they were gonna make it their own system, but the powers that be within their like their boss says, no, it has to be D&D, so people will buy it, even though that's not true. And then they make another 5.0 D&D game with the same kind of look as a 5.0 D&D game, and yeah, it's passable, it's feasible. You're playing this system, you're playing this, you're giving your players this experience, but could have been a much more true to form if you had allowed yourself to just not have to worry about that framing at all and start again, starting from that core concept and saying, like, this is what we want to get out of it. We need to get a system that suits it better. We got lucky, I think, with Powered by the Apocalypse for Moonpunk. It's been 5 years and or it's been 6 years actually. It's been however long it was since I decided to make Moonpunk, me and Alex. And I don't remember, although I don't remember a lot from 2019, 2020. A pretty traumatic time in our lives. I don't remember having a long discussion about whether we were going to use Powered by the Apocalypse or try something else out. We got lucky with the fact that it ended up working for the kind of game we wanted to make. Maybe we would have dumped it if we had run into some more roadblocks, but we didn't. Kind of, when you do start hacking a game, how do you know? Like, when did you know, Liana, when your Bleach 3.5 wasn't working within that system? How do we figure that out? Because I haven't had that experience, because I got lucky.
Was there a specific point where you're like, oh?
Honestly, well, so I actually, because I am a stubborn person, I was just kind of forging ahead, and what helped me out was the 4E announcement, actually. Because then suddenly, like, we have a new edition on the horizon. I have no idea what it's going to look like. And like, I'd just been kind of like pressing through this project with grit and determination, and I wasn't really having fun with it. Like, I was kind of proud of what I did, but the emotion I was most often having was frustration. And I think frustration can be very revealing. Like, if a project is on balance more frustrating than anything else, that suggests that you are not moving in the right direction. If it feels like a chore to try to make this work, that is a good sign that you are trying to fit the square peg in the circle or whatever. Like, listen to your emotional state as you are doing this. Like,
That's
are you
huge.
excited? Are you constantly like, oh, this is so cool, I can't wait to try this out? Or are you, I wish this worked differently, or I wish this was a bit better for what I'm trying to do. Like, those feelings of frustration are your sign that you're probably on the wrong track.
That's so huge and seems so obvious, but I don't know if that's super obvious to designers. Like, you should be feeling passionate and having fun with the game that you're making. I totally agree with that.
I do want to say too, like, some frustration is understandable. Like, it is not like game design is highs and lows and frustrations and all of that. It's when it becomes the overriding emotion associated with the project, I would say is that point where you're in a position where you should probably reflect further on what's going on. And that kind of was where Bleach D20 had ended up sitting with me. Like, yeah, there was cool stuff in there and I was happy with it. But it was just like, it was draining. It was frustrating. Trying to make this system that clearly was not designed to work, it didn't spark joy.
It should be a productive frustration, is the thing. If it's a destructive frustration that's making you want to quit, like, that's where things are going wrong. I agree. Like, the creative process is frustrating many times, but.
And that's, I think, I hear programmers talk about this a lot too, where they'll get super frustrated with the problem, but then they'll feel like a god when they overcome it. Whereas if you're in kind of a bad frustration loop, getting through a problem, you don't necessarily feel excited about it because then the next problem is rearing its head. So it's just kind of that like downwards cycle. You should have that euphoric moment if you break through, if you're breaking frustration, like it should break. You should feel good. And like it might come back with something else, but in that moment you should feel good about it. So if overcoming a, even like even if you're overcoming a problem or you're figuring something out, if your thought isn't like, hell yes, I am the best designer in the world, or whatever, right? If you're not like feeling at least a little euphoric over that, that's a warning sign, I would say.
I what about so you're on the right track. You're designing your game, you're in the midst of it, you feel like you have a good core mechanic, whether you're hacking it originally. How do we decide how much referral material to put into our game, whether that's like our setting or whether that's like all the little extras, tables, other mechanics that are new? How do we decide when we're going to be done with that and how it's integrated into our like core mechanic? I think talk like that there's a lot that can go into a game, and scope, deciding the scope of your game, I guess, is what I'm getting at. Where do we stand on that? How do we know when enough is enough?
I'll let Craig start. I also have a lot to say.
It ends up being kind of it's for me, it's always been kind of examining again what that core conceit, what the game is trying to do, what the game is about, and what there's one of the things that I always keep in mind too is that I trust the reader, I trust the player. When I, for example, did Capers, I was like, okay, it's set in the 1920s, it's an alternate history, but it's really just alternate history in mostly alternate history in that there are superpowered people. Like a lot of the events, World War I still took place, and there's Prohibition and everything that's happening in Prohibition is still there. And so there's a certain amount of information that a person who would be interested in that game might already know, or at least they might know like real legitimate historical stuff, or they might know like stuff that was presented in documentaries that may be out of date, that or that was presented in just movies in fiction. They'd be like, oh, I've seen The Untouchables. Like, I'm going to play a Capers game. I'm going to make it feel like Untouchables. And so that was the guiding light. I was like, I'm going to give people enough information, like an overview of the 20s, to give them a sense of like, okay, what who are the movie stars? What's going on in sports? Set the stage. Like what are the new inventions? How many people have cars? How much? Are there telephones? Is there electricity? All this stuff, just to like let people know. And then with the setting material, it was like providing enough information to kind of do it, but without letting the game book get super super big and thick, full of lore. And that's as much a necessity for my budgetary concerns as anything, because I personally would love to make a 350 to 400 page core rule book. I can't afford to. I do weird little genre mashup games that's never going to get the Kickstarter. Well, I can't, or at least I can't count on having a Kickstarter that's going to potentially do well enough that I can, fill that book with art and have it edited and print it. But then, like with Die Laughing, that was okay. The person that's going to play this game, even if they don't know horror movies, they know horror movie tropes. We've all absorbed them over time. So there's no setting, like no significant setting information and lore. It's just like, oh, you're in a horror movie. Use that. And there's a list at the back of the book for like, here's horror movie tropes, just to kind of remind you. But I don't get into detail with everything because the game didn't need it. So that game could be 100 pages long because it's all rules. Optional stuff, and then lots of monsters and lots of different types of characters to play. I just gave them a lot of options. And then I got to Code Warriors and was like, oh, this is a whole world. This like doesn't exist. I've got to do a lot more because I got to describe all these locations in this weird computer world that you're in, and figure out what everybody looks like and what do these programs look like. Because I'm not just going to mimic Tron because I don't own that license.
Tron and reboot. There you go.
And every other thing that's influences, lots of post-apocalyptic stuff influences that in that game as well, including my favorite one that I like pointing out is there's a Snowpiercer. There's basically a location that's a constantly moving caravan of cars that's basically Snowpiercer. There's like all this political stuff that's going on inside with the people, and nobody wants to get out because it's dangerous out there. But yeah, that's what it usually ends up being. It's figuring out what the frames of reference are that I can count on the players to kind of fill in, and then building to meet that.
Yeah. Leanna, what about you? What was your, well, how do you decide when you're done with your periphery, your scope?
All right. So first off, understand I am a businesswoman and a project manager in my day job. I run procurement. I do a lot of sourcing, and I do apply these skills to my game design. So with that in mind, I try very carefully to scope projects, and a lot of that is based around in my early development stages because I am developing in kind of the semi-professional space where I am trying to make something that will sell. Like I am trying to build a brand, I am trying to build a world and a setting and like a system that I want people to come back to. I want them to consume more media. Like I'm trying to make all of that. So within that, I am always looking at what do I need content-wise that will make this work. with the initial Valor system, we had a lot of content that we needed, but some things ended up on the chopping room floor. It just didn't work. Bells and whistles that were fun to have, but didn't quite make it. Stuff that I may be bringing back in a later book. I generally shot for creating something that would be like appropriate on someone's shelf. So Valor ended up being about 200 pages exactly. I felt pretty comfortable with that. We had a core system that worked. We had a variety of skills and abilities and things for people to customize their characters with. We'd extensively play tested it. The system worked. It worked well. I knew it worked well. And then past a point, it's like, all right, we're cutting this off. We just need to finish on completion now. Because early project management for me, this thing took us 10 years, right? Like, I don't want those kinds of cycles. So ultimately, and especially more recently, I'm trying to very early in define the scope that I want. So for the Foes book, I said, we're working on this. I'm hoping to get this kickstarted within probably early next year. I set a hard limit on Foes past a point. I said, all right, I need this much. I made sure that the divisions I'm kind of comfortable with of like X Foes in this level bracket and this enemy type bracket is very much like controlling yourself. Because, yeah, you could go forever. But I mean, as Craig pointed out, too, like there are financial penalties for going forever. You don't know if you can make that kind of money, right? So working within your space and knowing your limitations is very important. As a new designer, unless you've got like funding behind you from like a day job or something like that, don't expect a Kickstarter to be successful. Like if you're just, you know, if you're doing kind of like a sort of like basement short simple design project, yeah, you can take that to Kickstarter. You probably aren't going to get funded. Especially depending on how much you're asking for. There's so many good games, and a lot of people are using Kickstarter now for like more professional projects, people with names behind them. Even then, there's only so much to go around. I know whenever I kickstart for money that would get me across the finish line, but I've already invested a lot of my own funds to get me there. So don't expect that crowdfunding even is an avenue. Understand the resources you're working with. Understand the resources you personally are willing to invest into it. And build your scope around that.
I think building your scope around that and then also making sure that you do have a timeline. A lot of people don't set themselves up with realistic expectations about how long something will take for them, because that's going to be different for everybody. Especially if you're doing this as like a side job. I work a full-time, very demanding job that takes a lot of my time and energy and also creative energy. So I know that things take me a little bit longer during the school year than they do in the summertime. And I schedule my production cycle, try to, around that.
You should have seen her look when she said try to. She kind of gave this eyeball of like,
I try to.
We all make attempts and with the best of intentions. Yeah. And it never works out for anybody. No. So don't be too hard on yourself if you fail. But yeah.
But like, I think part of that like initial phase of like, I usually will start deciding what my plan is after I have my idea for the game and I've decided on a core mechanic. I've done a lot of brainstorming and like notebook writing and like talking with somebody about this idea. And when I'm actually serious about making the game, what Alex and I do is we have a document that's set up like, okay, here's what we're going to do. Here's when we're going to do it by. Here's what we're going to do. Here's when we're going to do it by. And that can be broader scope, like, okay, so we're going to write. It's usually when we're in the writing phase rather than in the like designing and iteration phase. We're going to write down this section by this date. It's going to be about this long. And then looking at that as a whole, like, does this make a complete game? Is this everything that we need? And sometimes you need to go back and check your, like, after you're kind of halfway through the project, see, like, is there more that I do need to add? Am I still following this goal? Am I checking in emotionally? Am I still feeling passionate about this project? Although at that point, the sunk cost fallacy can kind of kick in. I think just setting yourself up with, like, literally setting a goal and writing those goals down can go a long way for helping to make sure that you are staying on track. And you might not know what that looks like for your first game. You might not know if that's the system that's going to work for you for your first game, and try something different next time. I also have designed plenty of games where I didn't have a timeline and I was just kind of poking away at it when I wanted to until it turned into a game. So like the block of marble, and just keep chipping away at it until it's a person, until it's a statue of David.
Yeah. What's the quote, or paraphrasing? Got a block of marble and you cut away everything that isn't the person, isn't person.
Yeah.
The person's already in there. Like, you
Yeah.
just have to kind of poke away and tweak this and just that, and then I'll like, oh, and there it is. There's the game. And that is a moment that you may well experience when designing, where you kind of get to a point where you're like, oh, now it's, yeah. Now it's a game. Now it feels like it's really something, even if you're not done. Even if you've got a subsystem that you got to still work out, or you've got, the bulk of the setting information to
Yeah.
write.
But
I actually.
having that plan is the difference between, like you said, Liana, being a businesswoman versus being just a hobbyist. Like, if I'm just a hobbyist, I don't care. I'll just work on it for as long as I want to work on it. Maybe finish it, maybe don't. But if I'm coming at it from a business perspective, like, I gotta have a plan. A plan is what makes it a business.
And I wanted to talk about timeline too. Honestly, for me, a lot of my designs, my exploratory designs, start in a. Like, there are some core products that I am developing for Valor, and that's different. But I have some other things where it's kind of an exploratory thing. And you can't, you like, I wouldn't worry so much about setting a timeline for everything you work on. I would understand when that switch is flipping. Like, if you've worked on something and you are feeling good about it, you need to be very, very firm with yourself about, like, okay, I am professionalizing this now or whatever. I like this is now a project I want to see through to completion. I want to fund it, I want to release it, whatever. Once that happens, that's when you want to start working your timelines. That's when you want to start managing your project. A good tool is basically writing down and breaking everything down into, like, what kind of tasks do I need to accomplish? So, like, for foes, I've been working off a list of, like, I have X lore entries I need done. I have X stat blocks that I need done. And I'm just, chipping away with that, my contractors, and doing as we can. And I know I've blown several deadlines, but I've had so many other projects too that I've intentionally deprioritized certain things based on Kickstarter timelines, because there are optimal times to run Kickstarters, and we're in the holiday season right now, so it is not an optimal time. So I can put that on the back burner so I can work on A Time Adrift, which is this big actual play project in the Final Fantasy XIV setting that I'm working on. And I'm spending more time on that right now because that is more pressing. And that will happen too with competing priorities. Like, I work a reasonably demanding job myself. I don't have summer breaks because I do more of a, corporate thing, but it pays pretty good. So I can use that to fund myself, so that releases pressure in that direction. That's, you're working with your time, you're working with your resources, and you're working with your priorities to make everything work.
Do we have any final thoughts about, like, doing this? Like, okay, we're developing this system. Or is there anything that we any advice we've missed for a designer jumping into this journey?
The thing I wanted to throw out there was that we've talked about a whole bunch of things. There's plenty of stuff that we haven't talked about. There's a lot to learn, a lot to develop, a lot of trial and error. There might be, like, especially with my earlier games, I had like a to-do document, a to-do list of things that had to happen all the way from like now until when I go to a Kickstarter. And it didn't have dates associated with like when the Kickstarter goes, but it had like, there were certain things like, I want to have this done by, 2 weeks from now, this done by this month, whatever. But that was also, I let it be a living, breathing document, because I didn't know how long it was going to take me to do stuff, because I hadn't done a lot of this. I didn't know how long it was going to take me to write art orders and get an artist going and kind of deal with all of that. So I like the whole process of dealing with art was dealt very broadly. And I was like, that shifted and changed. And you know, you'll figure that stuff out as you go. I'm at the point now where I don't write that super detailed thing. I know what needs to be done. And I'll basically have an outline of like, here's the chapters that go in the book. And I'll basically break down what each of them is going to be. And I know that, you know, I know where playtest is going to fit in. I know where getting editing working is going, you know, going is going to fit in. And I don't necessarily have to keep track of it so detailed, but I usually do have, like when I start working on a game, I usually have a target for a Kickstarter. Mm. And it's based on my experience of knowing how long it takes me to do things, how long it takes freelancers to do things. And then the size and scale of the game is going to change that too. If you're doing a, you know, 30 page zine, you can crunch that thing in 3 months if you're really rocking on it. Whereas like a 150 page game, starting from the ground up, might be
take longer, you know, yeah,
couple years.
Yeah,
and it could be less, and it could be less, and it could be more, and you don't know when you're new because everybody works differently. So it's hard for me, it's hard for any of us to say, oh, it'll take you this long to write your setting. You know, setting yeah. might be the easy thing for you. You might just blow through setting material, but your mechanics might take a long time to figure out because that's something that you're not as skilled with, that you're still building that skill. So and be kind to yourself over all of that. Understand that.
Yeah.
You have thrown yourself in the deep end. And so you're going to have to be kind to yourself and just be like, okay, this deadline needs to push, or I need to refocus a priority here. Maybe I need a little help on something or whatever. Maybe the scale of this book needs to come down because I'm letting it get away from me.
Say, I mean, most people don't do, they don't have a creative project that they do and that they complete. If you are a person who's completing, whether it's for fun or for publishing, you are doing something that most people don't do. You're doing extra work by doing this. And hopefully you're doing it because you like it or because you have a goal that you're trying to achieve. But hopefully like you do it first of all because you like it.
I definitely have a few things. So we didn't touch on this, but I wanted to get into this because this is very important to me. Look for your community because they are out there. Blue Sky obviously has a very thriving tabletop RPG, but if you live in a major city or within driving distance or even like mass transit distance of a major city, there is probably a board and tabletop group in your city that you could go to.
More than one.
To like-minded people. And you're going to find ranges, right? Like some of the people are going to be more of those, a hobbyist, like I'm just doing this cool thing because I like it. And then some people are going to be more serious about it. But finding that community is very important because then you can start making connections with people who will like potentially be able to help critique your game, help you play tests, help give you ideas, help you break through some of those log jams that you run into. I think a lot of people may view creating a TTRPG as a very like singular personal experience, but in my experience, in my opinion, it's not. A tabletop RPG especially is designed to be played with a table of people. So you do yourself a disservice if you don't also have a table of people helping and supporting you along the way in your design process. You may be the core designer, but there is so much that other people are going to contribute that you just can't do. Like, no one can do it all. I mean, we talk about buying art all the time, but, you know, like, you can't really test this game with yourself more often than not. Journaling games are their own beast, certainly. But, like, if you are designing a game for a broad play, it behooves you to find a community of people who are, you know, at your table for the design process as well.
It's a little bit about kind of letting go of your ego too. Like you cannot come into this the assumption that you are going to be able to do it all by yourself. That's also part of the thing I was trying to get to with like deciding whether or not you're going to make your own system versus hack one. Like if you are making your own system just because of the sheer ego of it, know that you, again, I do a lot of things that is by an ego. This is, I am just saying what I've experienced. You are giving yourself a harder time for the sake of your own ego. Know that going in. Know that you are going to be battling your hubris. But I, for the like the actual social part about like getting with other designers and learning from their work, that is indispensable. You cannot out-hubris that. that is the, you know, you're going to have Sisyphus rock falling back on you if you try that out. There's a reason why most of the cool, really cool creative projects too, in all of creative, all the creative realms, most of them come from people who live in cities or moved to cities because they wanted to be with that creative group, because there's more people doing it. There's a reason why New York, Hollywood, Chicago, that's where people are making like theater and movies, because there's more people there who can talk with you. And the more brains you have with you, the better you're going to be. I'm a huge city fan. As a girl from a small town who moved to the big city, I have to put in a plug for Chicago. but I mean, the internet's also a city, so don't feel too bad.
Yep, that community. If you don't have the access that we've been talking about, the internet is an access point as well. And if you're listening to this, you have the internet. Unless somebody recorded it and put it on like your iPhone for you or something.
Very impressive. So.
Yeah, yeah. If you don't have the internet, and you're listening to this. Send me a letter at. What if I put my real address on here? Liana, thank you so much. Oh, sorry. No, you say what you're going to say before I say.
You can send me a telegram. Go down to Western Union.
Liana, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and talking to us today.
Absolutely. I always enjoy chatting, especially about game design. I could talk about it for hours.
For sure. Where can we find you and your stuff?
Oh, goodness. This has expanded. So my core project is Valor, the heroic roleplay system. You can find me at valorousgames.com or at ValorLiana on Blue Sky. I'm not really doing Twitter much anymore, but I do occasionally pop in, because I'm working on A Time Adrift, which I mentioned. A Time Adrift is a Final Fantasy XIV inspired timeline or project, actual play, based on a darker timeline that those who played and beat Shadowbringers will know what I'm talking about. That is launching in January. We're very excited. I'm working with a lot of content creators in the 14 space, and we're all super excited about it. We've actually been putting up lore videos every week with like cool narrations and stuff, and so that's super cool. Also, I am co-host with the Asians Represent podcast. I actually got to do the capstone episode of last season where we talked about trans people in anime throughout the years. That was a really fun episode. I sat down with Dr. Emma Yasui.
I have to listen to this. I gotta write this down.
Yeah, it was like probably one of my favorite podcasts that I've ever done. Where we talked about like trans characters in mainstream anime and manga, kind of starting with the 80s with Hibari-kun. But yeah, so you'll see me on the Asians Represent podcast. I usually do a few episodes per season. And I've just launched my own podcast called Worlds of Inspiration, where the first and third Friday of every month, and we actually just put out an episode yesterday that I need to boost on socials because I forgot to do that yesterday because I was really busy at work. But what we do is we pick a setting and we talk about like what we love about it, why it works, and what we can learn from it as a designer. And this week I'm actually starting a two-part with the RPG SEA crew. So a bunch of Southeast Asian developers who created a community online because it wasn't really much in their countries. So yeah, bringing that back to the design, you can find your people. You might have to look, but you can find them. They are out there.
I love that. Thank you again. Thanks for coming on. You can find me also on Blue Sky. I am no longer on Twitter at all. At Joska. And also I'm on Discord at Joska. Anyone can DM me. I think maybe, I don't know. You might have to friend request me. I like to talk on Discord. You can find my games at wannabegames.itch.io.
And I'm Nerdburger Craig on Blue Sky. You can find all the games at the web store at nerdburgergames.com, as well as at DriveThruRPG. And people on the Nerdburger Games Discord know that this is underway. But for the general public, Secrets of the Vibrant Sky, the third game in the series, is under development. In celebration of the 10-year anniversary of the company next year, we're going to have that pulled together before Gen Con next year. My co-designer Shireen and Gemma the artist are both under contract as of yesterday. And keeping in mind, we're posting this a couple weeks even later than we record it. So yeah, it's rocking and rolling. And in this version, this third game, you can play it standalone or you can play it as part of the series. And your character, who has been on the Vibrant Isle, is now exploring the magical sky above the Isle in the hopes of becoming a guardian of the island or of the Vibrant Realm. So this is like the end game. You're now. You started the series by arriving at the island, and now you're going to become one of the kind of spiritual guardian protectors.
That's super cool. I'm very excited for that.
Congratulations.
Yes, congrats. Thank you to Steph Sex for our opening and closing theme song, which is Avil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thank you, Steph Sex. And thank all of you for listening, and we'll see you back here next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.